Welcome to the 12th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a national dialogue on homelessness and poverty. Homeless, formerly homeless, or afraid you're about to be homeless, you may also call 1-866-LEFT-OUT. Homeless, formerly homeless, or afraid you're about to be homeless, you may also call 1-866-LEFT-OUT. We all know the saying, out of sight, out of mind, and for many of us, that may apply to the Gulf Coast. But the people who live there see it every day and can't forget their problems. There's too little affordable housing, too few good jobs, too little help for the people who really need it, and too much red tape even when the help is there. What are the people of the Gulf Coast facing? We'll ask that question right after this.
Dumpster diving to me is something that I depend on for subsistence. Obviously I could work and buy things like everybody else does, but I prefer instead to live off of stuff that would otherwise go to waste and end up in landfills. And I've been able to, for the past, say, four and a half years, do that really effectively.
This is Del McLean, who goes by Earthworm. Behind the strip malls at the .US 41, a group of dissenters is emerging as part of an international dumpster diving culture, people who literally live off of what stores throw away. Earthworm, a full-time dumpster diver, explains that dumpster divers follow a unique philosophy.
There's actually sort of two parts to the philosophy behind what motivates me to dumpster dive. One is that we don't want the stuff to end up in landfills and be wasted, but the other part of that is that we actually want to prevent consumerism because we're actually against the entire system.
This sort of anti-consumerist sentiment holds at its core the idea that most people spend so much of their day at work that they lose opportunities for more meaningful uses of their time.
Consumerism is a culture of depending on purchasing things in exchange for labor, usually. The idea that buying something will make you happier, fulfill your needs. I think happiness doesn't come from things. And in fact, a lot of the misery that is caused in our life has to do with that culture of consumerism.
When you deal with trash a lot, it kind of starts to mess with your assumptions and your realizations about why it's bad for you and if it's bad for you. You know, just because somebody put something in, you know, in a trash can or a dumpster, does that automatically make it undesirable? And once you start rejecting or at least questioning that assumption, you find out that there's a lot of really great stuff in trash.
It's also worth noting here that there are two main differences between storage dumpsters and people's dumpsters. First, the kind of trash that people throw out are scraps of food, used tissues, shards of glass, generally things you don't want to crawl through. But in dumpsters of stores, you can find unopened boxes of cereal, relatively fresh produce, and sometimes entire cases of baked goods. Any cosmetic damage to the outside of a package lands it in the garbage, regardless of the quality of what's inside. My grandpa, who was born in 1927, used to tell me that when he was a kid, he thought that if he could make $100 a week as a grown-up, he'd be a rich person. He told me that statement in jest to show how the value of the dollar has changed over time. And yet Earthworm, working two nights a week at a hotel while she studies to get her EMT certification in Florida, subsists on $100 a week, which she swears is enough to cover everything if you no longer have to pay for things like food, cleaning supplies, paper, computers, household appliances, and clothing. And not only do Earthworm, Marlin, and their roommates have virtually everything they need, they have it in excess. So they work with the local Sarasota chapter of Food Not Bombs, a collective of individuals who seek to use dumpstered food to feed the homeless. Every Friday since September 2006, Food Not Bombs has offered free meals in Three Points Park in downtown Sarasota.
Yeah, my name is Orange. How you doing?
Are you yourself a member of the homeless community?
Oh, yes, I am, yeah. Oh, it's a wonderful thing. You know, I still don't know these guys' names, but these are wonderful people, man, and it's getting even bigger, and it's a variety of people here. It's not just homeless people here, but there's other people that work, you know, here also that just come down, just be fed some food, you know, and mingle with the other people and just have somebody to talk to, man. It's down to earth, and that's a wonderful thing.
My name is Nick. I think that it's really nice to see people helping other people, especially in a period in time when the economy is so bad. Not all the people out here are drug addicts or alcoholics, and it's really good to see food not bombs come out here and help people to get to wherever they're going. Where would I go if it wasn't for people who cared? I wish that I could see the state diversify and support itself to help its people, particularly in this state right now where it's hard to get any progress in jobs or anything, even to temp agencies.
As Sarasota continues to be the number one meanest city to the homeless in the entire nation, dumpster divers here have made it their mission to provide for themselves and for others, all from the very products that so many of us unknowingly waste.
This is an excerpt from a longer story produced by Sam Greenspan.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Homelessness Marathon, where the numbers to call in are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. We are originating this year from Pass Christian, Mississippi, really right near Ground Zero where Hurricane Katrina came ashore. And we've been talking mostly about the poverty in the wake of Hurricane Katrina for the night. And in this hour, we have two people who are really experts on that and two people who have been a great help for this broadcast as well. I am joined tonight in this hour by Roberta Avila, who is the director of the Mississippi Interfaith Disaster Task Force, and also by Kathleen Johnson, who is the director of Hancock County Katrina Relief. And my welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, let's. The title of this hour is "What Is Mississippi Facing?" So Let me ask you both this. I think we've had a lot of discussion so far tonight about what has happened down here, but we haven't had as much discussion about what we're facing in the future. So let me ask you each. Roberta, as you look out from where you sit and in terms of what's coming down the pike, in terms of the challenges still remaining, what do you see?
Well, our organization is particularly focused on the unmet needs of our most vulnerable citizens, and those are the elderly, the poor, and the disabled. And what we see coming is still a huge challenge in helping those particular groups of people to recover from Katrina and to get back into permanent housing and affordable housing.
When you say a huge challenge, what can you be a little more specific about the kind of challenge that you're talking about?
Well, in our state, what's happened is we had a huge amount of federal funding that came down to the state in the form of community development block grant money, which our governor had complete discretion on how that money would be spent. And while the money has been spent for some housing assistance programs, grants. Not everyone qualified for those grants, and it was limited to people who had water surge damage in a specified area. But what we know is there were on the coast alone 7,000 households that experienced wind damage and could not apply for those homeowners grants. So they are totally dependent on charitable labor. They're totally dependent on volunteer labor, and we know, so much of that has already been done here, but so much more needs to be done. So that's the challenge.
All right. Well, Kathleen, let me move on to you now. Of course, you run a volunteer relief camp here, and you run an agency. I gather the number of volunteers is slowing down over time. What do you think we're facing ahead here?
Well, we're facing a natural attrition of the volunteers going into 4 years. There is a slowdown. We're not seeing it over the next few months because we are absolutely packed with volunteers over the next few months. But that's based on the fact that we have worked very hard to recruit those volunteers through national marketing of our own. There was no government program for national marketing to bring down volunteers or to solicit any help for us here outside of what the government had allotted through the CDBG grants, which at least and less than 20% of that has been spent on the poor. What we're facing here now is that we have had no funding on the table for recovery since May of 2008, and what little funding is now coming to the table is now packed with federal bureaucracy in the form of environmental assessments, which now we're told could take 3 to 6 months to perform on each little house, even if we're doing as little as a painting job. And as long as those clients put their name in for that grant, they have to immediately stop work on that house. So if we've got the house up but the roof not on, then we have to stop work and wait for them to do an environmental assessment, which means everything's ruined while we're waiting for the grant money to get here. So even if we get that grant money on the table, and even if we can get around the environmental assessments, for Hancock County, it means that we can either do 100 houses for small finishing jobs, or we can do 17 houses up to $60,000. And we are nowhere near close to getting done here in Hancock County. That's not even 1% of the remaining houses that need to be done.
Now, Hancock County, for those who are just joining us, is the hardest hit county on the Gulf Coast. And
Yes, it was. They estimate 90% of the housing here was either damaged or lost.
Now, the numbers to call in here on the Homelessness Marathon are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. Kathleen, you, in addition to running this relief camp, you also manage, well, there's something here called the Mississippi Case Manager.
It's the Mississippi Case Management Consortium.
Right, and you have case managers working for you. Could you tell people, first of all, what is a case manager?
My goodness, what is a case manager? A case manager is a facilitator. They facilitate and advocate on the behalf of their client. It is not intended that they enable the client, but to assist the client towards recovery.
These are the people to shepherd the clients through the process.
Yes, it's a very complicated, convoluted process, and when you're dealing with people from a wide assortment of educational skills, and in some cases what we're finding is we have people that are functionally illiterate. They are not able to navigate the road down to recovery at all. We have the very elderly, which are very timid, and that they have absolutely zero understanding of what the process is for rebuilding a house, because they've been well taken care of in their lifetime, never actually built a house, bought a house, and now they're sitting there with a slab and a FEMA trailer and absolutely zero understanding of what it's going to take to rebuild.
Well, I mean, why not? I mean, there was no rule that said Katrina only hit the most functional people. It hit everybody. That's the bottom line. And in as with other forms of homelessness, you know, I use this analogy, you know, flies land in your bathtub and so do spiders, but only spiders get caught in it. And the point is that a lot of people fall into difficult straits, but it's the ones who have a hard time getting out. Not everybody has a hard time. So
that's right.
The less functional people, the less able people, or the less wealthy people, they're the ones who get caught.
That's right.
And unfortunately, the way the funding worked for the CDBG grants, there was phase one and phase two. We really never got to phase three. But phase one actually addressed the more wealthy of the residents. And then when they got through with that, they went to phase two, which addressed the next level of wealth, and we never did get down to phase three.
Right, which I just wanted to say is that there was recently a quote by someone who benefited from phase one, and he was saying that if he hadn't gotten that $150,000 grant to repair his home on the beach, that his home would still be boarded up. And so I'm glad that his home is repaired, but there were thousands that were left out who didn't get even an opportunity to apply for a $150,000 grant to repair their home because they didn't qualify.
Okay. And I've got a lot of questions for you because there's a lot I don't understand. But we have someone at the mic, and I want to give out those numbers again, 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT if you want to get in on this conversation. Cricket at the mic, welcome back. I know you were there, and then you kind of had to get called away and never were quite finished with what you wanted to say. So, Cricket, welcome back. And what didn't we get to before?
Well, one of the things that I did want to cover was the mental health issues and the post-traumatic stress that has taken place. And I'm one of those people that's had to finally pick myself up and go get help, you know, to be able to cope with this situation. I have moved. I've been homeless since the storm. I've been in a camper. I had two cats that I actually had to put down that died of cancer, which I don't know if it had something to do with living in the camper. And as of last week, 2 weeks ago, I just got out. Somehow HUD found me in the system and called me and offered me some assistance. So finally, I'm in an apartment, but, you know, I'm still just kind of lost in the system. And, you know, it's just trying to get the help. I actually went last week and applied for food stamps. I'm 45 years old. I have always been independent. Never thought I would ever be in this position, you know, at this point in my life, because I retired when I moved over here.
Let me ask you a question. Along the way, did you have a case manager? Were you assigned a case manager?
No. What happened was FEMA umbrellaed me under my ex's FEMA number. And I requested a separate FEMA number because I lost a business, too, in the storm. And when I went to go apply for an SBA loan, they said I needed my own individual FEMA number. So I went through all this rigmarole with the notarized documents sent to FEMA and fought FEMA. And they basically told me, tough luck. That's the way we do it. So that's one of the things, is you got to mind your P's and Q's when you're talking to FEMA. Because in my opinion, I wasn't married, so it's not up to the government to marry me. You know, we pay separate taxes. We paid separate taxes with two individuals, two separate businesses, and we were put together, and neither one of us received anything. Well, he received like $5,200, but that was it. But I never got a dime. You know, nobody even knows I'm here. Nobody even knows my name, you know? And it's just, it's not fair, and everybody else in the country needs to be made aware of how the government works and their process that they use, because the red tape and the bureaucracy is just unbelievable.
Do you have a housing advisor now with the...
No. I've got the HUD, you know, that I went through, but that's done, you know. I'm in an apartment at this point, and they're paying a portion, and I'm paying a portion.
Okay. Well, you are supposed to have an assigned housing advisor in that apartment, and do you know who that person is?
No, I'm not real sure. Would it be the people at the HUD office?
No, you have an assigned worker.
No, I've never met an assigned worker. I've never been contacted by a soul. Nobody knows I'm here. I'm lost in the system, literally.
And that's part of the problem. They are working very hard, but every person in an apartment has somebody assigned to them. And so after this broadcast today, get with me and we will try and find out who that person is.
Okay.
You also can get a case manager if you can get with one of the church groups, and they will get you a volunteer case manager.
Okay. See, I'm not aware of all of this, you know.
Well, a lot of people weren't, and that's one of the problems of the recovery, is that the case management was never discussed openly, and it was a very hush-hush thing that some people got and some didn't. The reality is that 90% of people on the coast right now don't have one.
Right.
Because we moved them all over to a paid program. But we're working very hard to try and bring that back so that we have case managers so that you know what's going on.
Right.
Let me ask about a question that you raised. Roberta, how many people down here have you heard this story from that they're having psychological effects from the post-storm?
Well, what we know is first I want to just congratulate you and thank you. I'm just glad to hear that that you are on the road to recovery and that there's so many people like Cricket who are still suffering the effects of Katrina. And we know from the research that's been done and just from the conversations we've had with our colleagues who are providing emotional, spiritual care and mental health services that there are still thousands of people who are still in the recovery stage, and that we know that the biggest contributing factor to mental distress is the fact that people have not recovered their housing.
Right.
And the fact that for many reasons, crisis counseling was delayed right after the storm. It was limited in many respects. And so we've learned a lot from this storm about what we need to do different in addressing the emotional, spiritual care needs of people who are affected by a disaster. But the bottom line is that we still have many people who have needs. We want to encourage, and we're so glad that, Cricket, that you got the help that you need, that anyone out there who's still suffering from the effects of Katrina try to access whatever help that is available through our local mental health systems and
right.
or through their churches.
Well, you know, in myself, I've moved 12 times
wow.
since the storm.
That is incredible.
And I've been in a camper moving 12
oh.
times since the storm. So it definitely, you know, you I don't know, you become, you build up this wall, you
sure.
know. Because,
sure.
you know, you never know when the shoe's going to drop again.
That's right.
You know, you just never know. So you live each day in fear. I mean, I'm a cancer survivor.
Oh.
And after living in a camper for 3 years and having to put two cats to sleep
yeah.
for cancer, I'm wondering, and it wasn't even a FEMA camper. This is one that somebody gave me when I evacuated,
gotcha.
You know, which I was very fortunate. But, you know, I wonder about myself living in that environment for 3 years. Yeah. Am I going to? No, should I go get checked?
Cricket, yeah. hang on a second. We got somebody on the line
sure.
I want to bring into this conversation. We have, I can't quite read it, Ondine from Indiana. Is Ondine there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. And welcome to the Homelessness Marathon. What would you like to say?
Well, I used to be a squatter, which is a bit like, you know you have to be homeless, so you pretend like you're doing it on purpose.
Uh-huh.
And then my I went all over pretty much the United States by hopping trains, not a good idea, hitchhiking, not a good idea, and I would spare change, and I could make more money on the street just from kind people putting change into a bucket or something like that. And I came home because my mother was sick. And I felt like it was safer out on the streets than at home at that particular time in my life. My mom got sick. I came home. She's sick. My dad's sick. And they're divorced. And then I found out that I'm terminally ill.
Well, I'm sorry to hear
and
that.
Whenever I was found out I was terminally ill, my sister was in a relationship with a guy who was really abusive, and he lived in our house. And I was like, look, it's either him or me. And my mother basically just pulled one of those, well, I'm not going to make a decision, but I'm not going to kick your sister out because she's fragile and you're strong, that kind of thing. So I had to be homeless in the local area for about 4 or 5 months. And that, I mean, I was squatting for years. And it really, really sucks because I remember whenever I was on the street, I could spare change more than I make now. On disability, I make less than $700 a month. I can't live on that. I don't even get food stamps.
Where are you living now?
Indiana.
No, I mean, what is your situation that you're in?
Well, I don't have enough money to move out on my own, and I'm physically ill. I'm on SSI, and I have to live with my parent, and I'm over the age of 21, which sucks. And basically, it used to be like, okay, yes.
Did we lose Ondine? Well, I'm sorry, Ondine. We seem to have lost you. So those numbers to call in, if Ondine wants to call back, anybody wants to call in, we're at 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. And, you know, I'm very sorry we lost you, Ondine. Certainly, we all wish you the very best. You're facing a very tough road. Oh, that's for sure.
Well, she's bringing up an interesting point because we have a real issue down here with health care for the poor and those impacted by Katrina. And it's so critical that it's severely impacted our hospitals to the point of jeopardizing our local hospitals' fiscal stability.
Well, now, we had Elijah Mitchell on and earlier, and he seemed to feel that health care was kind of back to pre-Katrina levels. Is that not your impression?
No, not at all.
What about you, Roberta? What do you think?
Health care in general? Well, will you say more what you mean, Kathleen, and then I want to say something.
I'm talking about the indigent poor having access to health care.
Right,
I've actually
yeah.
been turned away at the hospital door here in Hancock County with a client in hand.
Really?
Yeah, I brought the client to the door, And somebody, the nurse came out, saw me coming across the parking lot with this particular client, came to the door and announced that there were no beds at the hospital.
Now, is this, though, a different problem from the healthcare problem that everywhere in the country you have with indigent clients, and they're dumping patients out on Skid Row and doing terrible things? Do we have a different problem down here in Mississippi from that?
I don't think they're dumping clients. I just think they have an inability to fiscally take care of them. There is no plan.
Oh, yeah, they're dumping clients all around the country. They're taking people out of the hospital and dropping them off at a homeless shelter.
You know? I'm not hearing that there, no. But that you haven't.
Don't have the shelters down here.
No, we have no shelter here, but I do know that I've had trouble getting them into the hospital. And it is a problem. And unfortunately, when they get sick, they do go to the emergency room, and they have no ability to pay.
Right. I think what Elijah was talking about, the fact that he works for a federally funded clinic called Coastal Family Health that makes every effort to take anyone who comes in and provide health care, but it's a clinic. And so one of the things that happened right after the storm was there were a lot of free clinics that sprouted because like you said, right after the storm, there was that huge need. And I know of one clinic that is still operating, which is Bethel Lutheran Free Clinic. So I would agree with what Kathleen has said, is that people just don't have the ability to pay for medical care, and can't get it or won't get it because they don't have the money if they need something more extensive than a flu shot.
Undine is back on the line, so let's go back to Undine. Undine, are you there again?
Yeah, I'm back. I don't know. I keep getting cut off.
Well, it's not you. I think it's our problem here, but whatever it is.
I'm on a prepaid phone. That might be why, but what I was saying is that basically when you're sick, you're just as invisible as whenever I was a squatter. Mm-hmm. But at least whenever I was a squatter, there was the kindness of strangers who gave me money and listened to me. And now it's just like there's so much family issues, it doesn't even matter that I'm sick. And with the amount of money I make, I can't live in a house by myself, which I desperately need for my own sanity's sake. And I can't even pay my medical bills for $700 a month, less that.
Well, we're very sorry. And you know, again, I think this is one of those kind of obvious points, but it's something that needs to be said. There's no help for you? Have you tried to get help? Did we lose Undine again? Oh, we lost Undine again. Cricket, let's go back to you and those numbers. I don't know if our phones are working or not, folks, or if that was Cricket's phone. I'm sorry, that was Undine's phone, but it's 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. Cricket, where do you stand now? I mean, what do you need to be made whole again, as the phrase goes?
Well, it's the lack of income, the lack of jobs in Hancock County. Businesses are closing daily in Hancock County. Everybody is struggling to try and stay afloat. I had a business after the storm. I was the third food business open in Bay St. Louis, and it only lasted 5 months. And when I shut it down, there was 32 restaurants that had opened. And I don't know what we've got at this point, because most of those have closed or cut back their hours.
Yeah, there was a restaurant I was eating at when I first came down here, and it's already gone.
Right, you know? And it's unfortunate, because these people have invested all of their money, you know, to try and make a living and keep a roof over their head, and they're losing their businesses. And I don't make near the money I made before the storm, nowhere close, because there's no opportunity in Hancock County. You know, jobs are very, very hard to come by. And if you have one, you hold on to it as tight as you possibly can.
And again, I keep coming back to this. Well, maybe Kathleen, you can answer this. Why should jobs be hard to come by in a place where there's so much construction work going?
Well, the truth of the fact is there's not a lot of construction work going on. If you look around, there's a lot of construction work that needs to be done. But I have contractors coming into my office daily, seeing if I have any subcontract work for them. And unfortunately, since we've had no grant funding on the table, there is no funding for them as subcontractors. It's contracting as we know it in Hancock County, except for some major jobs that were pre-funded, has come to a screaming halt.
Let me give out those numbers again. 877-NOBODY-8 or 866 left out. Cricket, I want to thank you very much. What you want to say?
Yes. I appreciate you guys doing this. It needs to be said. The rest of the country and the rest of the world really needs to know what's going on, because you have to learn from what we've been through. You know, we've done some things that have never been done before, and everybody needs to know. And I really appreciate y'all having me on.
Well, we thank you very much. Thank you very much for participating in the marathon. We're having a little bit of a meltdown in our communications with the booth. I can't really speak to the people in the booth. I just want the people in the booth to know that I'm up and running here as far as the internet is concerned, if anybody wants to come out and set things up right. Roberta, yes. What are the groups you work with? Now, you work with a wide coalition of groups, right?
Right. We work with a coalition of organizations. Well, first, the disaster recovery organizations, which are a number of faith-funded recovery organizations and other organizations that are trying to assist people affected by the storm through case management. And then another coalition that I work with is the STEPS Coalition, which is a coalition of other nonprofits, some of the same groups but some different, that are working together to ensure a just and equitable recovery on the Gulf Coast.
And is there a kind of, I want to ask you about this, but let me start with you. Are the groups starting to wear out, or are you seeing more, or are you seeing less ability of these groups that you work with to cope?
We're wore out.
Kathleen says we're wore out. It's interesting in that this, one of the things that my organization convened was a collaboration of recovery organizations for our Katrina Recovery Summit. And it was surprising to me that we had the kind of response that we did for this last summit, because we had over 300 people come. I just expected that, given that this was the second summit, that we'd only have about 150 people come, and we had over 300. So, but I think what it speaks to was, because the theme of our summit was, where are we now, and what are we going to do to ensure that everyone recovers, is that all of those people were there, which to me is an affirmation that there are lots of people who still not recovered, that there's still huge concern. But I think that Kathleen has already touched on the things that are slowing us down in the recovery, which is the funding isn't there. Volunteer labor continues to come, and Kathleen's group continues to be able to draw volunteers, but we need thousands more in order to help everyone recover. So to your question, people are definitely wore out and tired, and people like Kathleen and others who've been here almost from the very beginning are worn out. And, you know, it's always a question of how much longer can we go on? And I say that again to say that I think it's grossly unjust that the populations that we serve have to rely entirely on, almost entirely on charitable giving and volunteer labor. And that's my concern, is that because our most vulnerable citizens didn't have access to easy grants that would have helped them recover, it's just a question about whether or not they're going to be able to recover. And I think that many things are compromised. Their health is compromised. Their emotional, spiritual care, well-being is compromised if they can't get back into their homes.
Kathleen, I have heard it said, and you manage caseworkers, that caseworkers start to burn out quickly, like in 6 months or something?
Sometimes quicker than that. The training has been rather short for case management. The original training for case managers was 2 days, and that was stretched to another half day if they took a class to learn how to access CAN. but we've really not come up with a definitive answer for training case managers at all. And case management needs to be ongoing training, and we've never been able to provide that, mostly because of the lack of funding. Everything comes down to funding, and we've never, for this entire recovery effort, have we ever had a master plan. There is no master plan on the table, period.
I've seen that down here just in my brief time. There seems to be no guiding intelligence to what's going on down here.
And the whole system was fractionalized because all the nonprofits pitched in to help make this work. Unfortunately, there's no lineage and no direct line. There's no continuity all the way up to the governor's office. There's a disconnect at every turn. It's just the way this system works. And if we were to do this again, we really need to sit down and develop a master plan and develop a line of command and a chain of command so that the messages can get up and down the line without having to go to extraordinary means, such as putting on a marathon, in order to get the word out. We should not be forced to do this.
Well, it's crazy down here. There's no question about it. And I heard one person say to me, though, that he could not be a case manager anymore because he was tired of telling people there was hope when there wasn't.
Oh, yeah.
Have you heard anything like that?
I hear that from my case managers, but at this point, a case management has come down to collecting statistics so that we can show what the need is. And so collecting the statistics is just as important, quite frankly, as dishing out the resources, because if we're short on resources, we need to be able to explain very succinctly what the problem is. And so while case managers might not be happy with the lack of resources at this time, there is another job that they can do and do very well.
I would give out the numbers again, but our phones seem to be down at the moment, I'm sorry to say. But we do have someone at the mic. What is your name?
Geraldine.
Well, Geraldine, welcome to the microphone. And welcome to the Homelessness Marathon. What would you like to say?
Well, I'd like to talk about the homeless. And I'd also like to thank Ms. Kathleen Johnson for getting me out of my tent and getting my shed.
Yes.
You were my first rescue.
And my FEMA trailer.
Yes.
Even though I got formaldehyde, I'm still in it.
Yeah.
But they gave me an extension till April the 1st, and I have to be out of it.
Yeah. Do you have a case manager at this time?
Never have.
Well, you've always had me, but I lost track of you after we got you in the FEMA trailer.
Okay, so you was my case manager?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now I know who to get in touch back with.
Yes, you do.
Can you, Geraldine, tell us your story? Where were you when Katrina hit?
When Katrina hit, I had come out here in June 21st in 2001, and I was right here in Pasco Christian.
Okay, and were you here for the storm?
Yes, sir.
And
I stayed through it.
Oh.
Boy, and so were you on, there's not exactly any high ground in Pass Christian. If you know this area, you know it's 26 feet is as high as it gets. So were you inland? Where physically were you?
Actually, I was on the other side of the tracks. Mm-hmm. I don't know the street exactly, but in the house that we was in, we only got water, wind, and some tree damage. We got more damage from Rita, but I wasn't here for Rita. But what I like to talk about is, like I told someone else, the problem is there. We still have so many homeless that they're not able to get to the north side of Bay St. Louis and Waveland. That's the problem we're having. And Ms. Kathleen Johnson is a testimony to that. She knows that as much as she's been out there, that we got forgot about. We got slipped through the cracks.
Can you take us back to the immediate, right after the aftermath of Katrina? You were here. Who brought you food? Who brought you water? Did your neighbors help each other? What was it like in those days?
No, we had... Actually, where we were staying, I was staying with my sister's future in-laws,
mm-hmm.
and there was a little Chinese store down the road, and they had been shopping with them for quite a bit, and they opened their doors and sold what they could at a reasonable price. After that, we couldn't do nothing for at least 3 days until we got some food and more ice and water in.
So in other words, they didn't gouge you. They just sold what they had, and then it was gone. There wasn't
gone.
There was no resupply.
No.
And it took 3 days before help arrived.
And the only reason we was able to get out of here was because I had a brother-in-law from Texas that was in Pascagoula that brought us gas in to get out.
In other words, you had to have family come in.
And thank God they were there. They're not no more.
No, where was the National Guard? Where were the... You're just waiting. People can't see you, but you're just waiting. You're just raising your hand like, well, who knows where they were?
We still don't know where they were. I mean, we do because they were on the south side of the tracks.
But
not the north side. They wouldn't let nobody cross over the south side of the track.
South side was worse hit, of course. But you're saying that there wasn't enough guard troops to go around. There was plenty of need, and they maybe hit some of the hardest hit places. But there was just a lot of people just left to fend for themselves.
Oh, yeah.
And
my youngest sister's brother-in-law, after the storm, he was in Ocean Springs. He come over to help find the bodies. He went through a hard time. He's still dealing with the mantle and all that, but he's holding up. My worries is, what am I going to do after the first?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, first of all, we need to get you back down to the office. Hey, we just start all over again.
March 1st is the deadline for... You're in a Mima cottage now, are you?
No, I... Number to get one.
No, she's in the original FEMA trailer that we had.
Didn't the FEMA people get an extension?
Yeah, she did get an extension.
So you've got another 2 months now, right?
No, yeah. I just got to March the 30th.
I don't understand. I thought all of the FEMA people got an extension.
Yeah, you got an extension.
You got an extension?
Yeah, that was till March the 30th. That was the last extension I received, and I received that Friday.
Really? Oh, well, because they're...
I thought it was April 30th.
Yeah, I talked to FEMA.
That's what I thought, too, but...
Yours says March 30th.
My paper said March 30th. Well,
now, well, I also want to say that I talked to four guys from FEMA who were not very happy with me because I had published a column about what's going on down here just when the extension came in, and when the extension came in, it was too late to call the column back, so they said I wasn't accurate and all that, and whatever, and I talked to them, and they tell me the good news is that there is no eviction process. They're telling me no one will be evicted from a FEMA trailer, that there is no eviction process in FEMA. That's what they told me.
Well, what this brings to light, really, this case right here, it brings to light the critical need a case manager plays in the residents' recovery. Without case management, they don't get accurate information.
That's right.
And when they get inaccurate information, they don't know where to go. And this is why we are pushing for more funding for case managers so that we can stop cases like this happening.
Because FEMA keeps asking me, why haven't you gotten Section 8 housing or HUD? I can't get none of it. I just can't get none of it.
Well, you know, if you listen to FEMA, and I have had the privilege of listening to the FEMA people, they will spend, forever telling you all the wonderful things they've done. But would you say that is the perception down here is about how wonderful FEMA has been?
I've got a shirt that right after FEMA come out.
Right.
That FEMA girls went wild. They ain't seen girls go wild yet.
Well, I have to butt in here a little bit. There is nobody that stood behind me and supported me helping clients more than FEMA. FEMA's the only thing that ever let FEMA down was bad employees, and one bad employee can go a long way in creating a lot of ill will.
Well, what about the bad employees in the top of the federal government? I mean, there doesn't seem to have been much will down here. FEMA can only, in their defense, they can only do what they're told them to do.
Right.
They're not an independent agency.
Yeah, they're mandated by the Stafford Act, and it's a very tight act, and they can only do what they can do.
But like you said, they were so understaffed, too.
Yeah.
All right, let me break in. Our phones, I believe, are back up again, even though my board here is not up again. Those numbers to call in, and we invite your calls, are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. And Ondine, I'm told, is back on the line, and I'm glad to hear it. Ondine, are you there? Well, maybe Ondine is not back on the line.
I feel bad about poor Ondine. We've lost her.
Right. We've lost her.
But I want to say something. I'm sorry. What is your name again?
Geraldine.
I want to say something, Geraldine, and something that Kathleen just said. And I would agree with Kathleen that we've been working with some wonderful women, primarily, and some men who are what are called FEMA VALs, voluntary agency liaisons, who've been doing everything they can to help us with the system that we had through FEMA to get assistance. Mm-hmm. And so they have been helpful to us. But I would agree, Jeremy, that I would agree there's bureaucratic problems that were there when FEMA started operating. I'm hoping they'll change. But the huge concern I have is we've had numerous deadlines for people to get out of their FEMA trailers or their transitional housing, and it's like Geraldine said, it's extremely stressful because they don't know where they're going to go.
I was going back to my tent.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Well,
I was going back to my tent on my land.
Right. And
over my dead body.
Yeah. And you know, and so
There's a lot of people would take you up on
God
that.
God bless you.
This is the first time I've heard, and I hope it's a direct result of the Obama administration, that no one's going to be evicted. But the bottom line is it's extremely stressful when people get these letters in the mail that say, you have until April 30th, because April 30th, nothing magical is going to happen. We aren't going to have the kind of affordable housing that people can move into. Yeah, we got lots of housing, but it's not affordable by their income standards. And these vouchers that we need that are huge are not going to magically appear, or maybe they are, on April 30th. So my huge concern is that we've had deadline after deadline after deadline, which creates a tremendous amount of stress on people. And so the good news I've heard this evening is that no one's going to get evicted.
Well, that's what they say. Let me hang on a second. I'm going to try and get Ondine back on again here. And those numbers are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. And I think the phones are working now. Ondine, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me? Yeah.
Yes, I can. That's great. So
okay. I want to make a comment on... I'm sorry I didn't catch her name, because I was kind of like talking to another guy, so he kept telling me to hold on because apparently my sound wasn't going through, about Section 8 and HUD.
Yeah.
Like, okay, Section 8 where I live in Indiana. We had a lot of flooding. I don't know if you guys remember that.
We do.
But, like, you can't get on Section 8. You can't get on HUD. They told me the only way I could get a house is if I had a baby. I don't have a baby.
Amen.
All right.
So, I mean, the whole system's a bit crooked, in my opinion. And this is someone who's been in the system her whole life, you know? And now that I actually, like, need help, I can't even get food stamps.
Well,
because I allegedly make too much money. How is, like, I only have, after I pay, you know, half of what I need to live it with a parent, I have, like, $300 approximately left for medical bills and for food and for everything. And it's amazing how, like, people say, oh, people who are disabled or people who are homeless choose to be that way and stuff like that. And, I mean, like, I was even considering going back out on the streets just so I could spange and make more money.
Who have you approached? Ondine, who have you approached for help?
I've approached pretty much every government system here in my town. I've approached everybody.
All right. Well, Ondine, I'm going to move.
And I wanted to know if there were any, like, you know, grants or anything that we could get, like people who are on SSI, because everything's considered income. If I get a gift that is cash, that's considered income. I have to report it.
I just want to say to Ondine is that if you're paying 50% of what income you have on rent and housing, that's extremely high, that people really shouldn't be spending more than 30%. So I can certainly understand why you're having financial problems in meeting all of your expenses. And I'm just hoping that our new administration will listen to that and hear that and know that the amount of money that you're getting on SSI is insufficient, and if it doesn't,
yeah, I mean, like,
if it doesn't
the
increase,
the only place I could live is like New York, and that's the only place that I can afford to live. But then again, New York's the cost of living higher.
I'm not sure
so
I follow that, but
well, New York is $1,000 a month, oh. And say for example, like Las Vegas is like I think like $500.
You mean they pay more, but at the same time it costs more.
Different cities.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, like if it's in with the state, you get more money.
Okay, Nina, unfortunately we've got to move on, but I'm glad that we got you back. Can you tell us one last thing that you want to tell people about your situation? And we all wish the best for you, of course.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, I would just advise younger people, like I did a lot of stupid things whenever I was younger, and I would just advise younger people that if they're thinking about leaving because they have a bad, stressful situation at home, to just try and find a safe place to go.
Amen.
Because once you get caught up in it, you can't really find your way back sometimes.
Well, good
luck to you. I've lost literally over 200 people in my life because of homelessness and drug overdoses while they're on the streets and stuff. So,
well, good luck to you, Andine, and we really, all of us, wish you the very best.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you. And I got a message that Randall said he has actually gotten a copy of an eviction notice, but if Randall can call in or tell somebody again, are we talking about an eviction from MEMA or FEMA? Because FEMA says it doesn't evict people. On the phone, I'm told we have Huckabuck from Los Angeles, California, who used to be homeless. Is Huckabuck on the line? Do we have Huckabuck?
Yeah, Randall.
Oh, well, I have Randall. All right. I don't know what
yes,
I'm...
I did get... See, I had the news media at my house, and the head of MEMA, Michael Womack, in response to my news story, have it in videotape, said that they would not be evicting people. 2 weeks later, I received an eviction notice by the sheriff that I had to remove off of my property within 30 days.
And this was related to MEMA, Mississippi Emergency Management Agency.
Correct. So I wouldn't take what FEMA says in the bank because they're both connected with each other. And I was told the exact same thing by MEMA, so I wouldn't get the people's hopes up.
Okay, but we have not yet seen an eviction notice from FEMA.
No, and you won't, because there is no process for evicting from FEMA trailers on private property.
Okay, but what about on... Well, there's not that many that aren't on private property.
The ones that are in parks are covered by leases, and once those leases are up, then FEMA has to remove those trailers.
Okay.
Oh, I got you. So it's only private property where there'll be no evictions.
All right. Well, Randall, thank you very much, and good luck to you. Good luck to you.
Like I say, I have a copy of the eviction notice. Thank you.
Thank you. Those numbers, again, are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. We've had a little fluffing around here with these phones and every other part of our system here, but I think we're good to go. Do we have Huckabuck from Los Angeles or not? I don't hear any Huckabuck out here, so...
I'd like to talk about Section 8 a little bit. Could I do that?
Go for it.
One of the things that we're finding with Section 8 is I did find a lady out not very far from you, Geraldine, the other day, who was out there erecting a tent for her and her son. Her son was 12. And we brought her in, and we got her a Section 8 voucher from Bay Waveland. But unfortunately, when we took that voucher to go and get her into housing, we discovered that she needed $800 deposit to get into the rental apartment. She needed $250 to pay for the electricity deposit, and she needs another $50 to pay for the water deposit. So the Section 8 voucher, while it is a great blessing, comes with another burden that nobody wants to talk about.
That we can't afford.
And if we're going to be handing out Section 8 vouchers to our clients in that need housing, we need to subsidize it further with these deposits.
Right.
Because without it, we can't get them into housing.
Now, it's worth noting that in some places in this country, a Section 8 voucher is pretty much useless because they just don't pay enough in some of the higher rent places, although that's coming down. I've got a note here that Huckabuck is back. Why not? I'm a mad, impetuous fool. I'm going to go for it. Huckabuck, are you there?
Huckabuck is here.
All right. Yay.
All right, Huckabuck, in L.A., what would you like to say?
I'd just like to throw out a couple of plugs. And I'm for the positive, not the negative, about the homeless situation. You got to excuse my talk. I got a couple of front teeth missing. I'm planning on getting it replaced.
Okay.
So bear with
no problem.
If you can.
Nope.
Yeah, that's a comment. I listen to your guests talking about, you know, their thing up in Olympia, Washington, and stuff.
Yeah.
You know what they're doing with the community, the you know, having little sites for the homeless people. Well, that's good. There's a lot of many people in the nation just, you know, just intelligent and working on the problem with homelessness as well as other problems such as GaryNoel.com or KPFK, something's happening in Hollywood, you know, or KPFK 90.7. You can check it out on the internet. Evan Ray, she's also on that show. And it's also a website. You can check it out on YouTube, or, you know, you can see the whole video. It's Zeitgeist, the Addendum. That's Zeitgeist, Addendum. Of course, I'm pretty sure they know how to spell Addendum. But, yes, it's renewable fuel, sustainable living. All of this is viable due to the fact, you know, like what maybe set me off about calling, wanted to talk to you guys was one individual was talking about anarchy. There's nothing wrong with anarchy. You know, saying you can, we as individuals can govern ourselves. We do need resources, and I'm just hearing about certain communities in the area or regions of the country acting. Officials, government officials, possibly for donated land or something like that, which is a good start, you know.
Yeah. Well, I know there are people who are anarchists. I'm not one of them, but but it is. Well, they'll tell you it's not the same as everybody shooting each other.
Yeah. But see, a lot of people they forget about Maslow. You know what I'm saying? One thing an individual needs is sheltered food. Shelter, food, clothing, and love. And, you know, some of those are being met, you know, through, you know, the different organizations around the country, you know what I'm saying, who's trying to start these endurance camps, if you want to say it like that. But, there's good things that are happening. I mean, what you're doing, you say you've been doing it for 15 years or so?
Just 12.
Well, with 12, that's a great thing. You're doing great.
Well, thank you. And I'll tell you, at this hour of the night, it feels like I've done all 12 years in a row. But listen, I want to thank you very much, Huckabuck, for the call. We're almost out of time. I have another caller now lined up, now that the phones are open. But to the other caller, I hope you will just hang on until after our break and let us wrap up here. Geraldine, what is your immediate hope right now?
Well, my immediate hope and prayers right now that if I do get kicked out of my trailer, that... because I got in a wreck in December, and because of my Medicaid, they are going to make me flat broke next month. If I get an apartment and something happens that maybe somebody might help me or I get in a wreck, where am I going to be?
So you need,
back
an,
on
you
the
need
street.
A place. Okay.
Right.
Thank you very much, Geraldine. And in about 15 seconds each, if you're talking to Obama, Roberta, what are you telling him now that you need down here?
Well, I heard some good news on in a newspaper article about there's going to be some funding coming down. We need funding for the kinds of gaps that exist that we've heard about to ensure that people who can get a voucher can get back in their homes and to ensure that people like our last speaker just said that to get her the assistance she needs so that she doesn't have to go back into a tent.
What I'd like to see is we need to get some funding on the ground to restart this building process. We have to get through the bureaucracy and leave it aside, and let's get the funding on the ground where it's needed, like it was a year ago, so that we can get some of these homes finished and we won't have homelessness.
Kathleen Johnson of Hancock County Katrina Relief and Roberta Avila of the Mississippi Interfaith Disaster Task Force. I want to thank you both for being my co-hosts here on the Homelessness Marathon. We're up and running. Our phones are running and everything, and we'll be right back after this short break.
You are listening to the Homelessness Marathon, produced in conjunction with Community Radio WQRZ of Waveland, Mississippi. The opinions expressed in this broadcast are not necessarily those of the producing or participating organizations or of the originating and affiliated radio stations. To order CDs of this broadcast or to contact the Homelessness Marathon, go to homelessnessmarathon.org.